I want to take a moment and discuss a very specific, what I see, and I think a lot of us would agree, is a very serious public health need in the state of New Hampshire, and that's pediatric cancer. According to the Center for Disease Control, New Hampshire had the highest rate of pediatric cancer between 2003 and 2014. It's unacceptable. It's alarming. And we can't allow the trend to continue. I think we can all agree on that. We have to work together to find answers, create solutions, and lead the way out of the crisis. So in my budget next month, I will use our surplus funds to commission a study once and for all to determine both the extent of the crisis and provide real solutions for the citizens and family of our state. The study will have no partisan agenda and, frankly, no preconceived notions. The mission is simple. Figure out the truth and use the data available. Develop sound policies that simply help these kids. Answers are not going to come overnight, but we will make it a top priority of the administration. Now, another significant public health crisis, as we all know, unfortunately, is the opioid crisis. And last year, as we saw, if you've read the news, the overdoses across this country are going up, unfortunately. Now, God bless it, here in the state of New Hampshire, we've actually seen a decrease in overdoses. We're actually bucking that trend. It is a good sign. It is a great sign. But we know there's a lot more work to do. And as we mentioned this week, just a few days ago, 211 took their first calls to triage individuals just after New Year's. The hub-and-spoke model went live. 9 locations across the state opened the doors. We're calling it the doorway. It's just getting off the ground. It's exciting. Working together. Really seeing what the needs are across the state. The idea that you finally don't have to travel 200 miles out of Pittsburgh, New Hampshire, down to Manchester to get the type of care, the type of treatment, the type of recovery that is going to work for you. To have these hubs across the state working in folks' individual communities so they don't have to worry about being separated from their job or their family. It's an incredibly exciting time. It's a New Hampshire model and someone I think we should all be proud of. And when you combine that with what we're doing with our Recovery Friendly Workplace Initiative, which had a very exciting, we crossed a very exciting milestone, the fact that we have, for the first time in a long time, a fully funded alcohol fund with over $10 million sitting available and flexible to provide a lot of these spokes, to provide a lot of the services in the individual communities in both the Southern Tier and across, whether you're in Monadnock, whether you're in COAS, the funds are available. The tools are available. We have more tools. We've created more tools, frankly, than we've ever had at our disposal before. The trend is going in the right way. We're creating an infrastructure, not just for the next 2 years, but truly for the long term. And that's very exciting. And the Recovery Friendly Workplace, I want to brag about it a little bit. I'm governor. I get to brag every once in a while. It's working. It's exciting. And we crossed our 40,000th employee. 40,000 employees now work in a business that proudly calls themselves Recovery Friendly in just a few months. It's wonderful. So again, I just want to reemphasize whether it's a public sector solution, a private sector solution, working with nonprofits, working in the government agencies, whatever it might be, it's all there on the table for us. There's still a lot of work to do, but again, we'll keep working to build a system and win the war on drugs. Now, just 2 short years ago, we had another very significant crisis when we took office, and that's the one we all know about over at the time at the Division of Children, Youth, and Families, DCYF. It was in crisis. We needed new management, we needed more caseworkers, we needed more funding, and at the end of the day, it all just meant that children were at risk. So what do we do? Well, I believe that turning around an operation begins with leadership. And so first what we did is we brought in a world-class team. And I tell this story a little bit, but it's so true. Of all places we looked, We went to New Jersey. No, you can laugh. We don't do that very often. But New Jersey had a model that had turned themselves around. They had gone from one of the worst to one of the best child welfare systems in the country. And they didn't just do it with pouring more money at it. They did it with, again, good management, focusing on caseworkers, focusing on individual needs, regulatory reform. And we went and we plucked Joe Ribsum, who was really key and instrumental in transforming New Jersey's program, and we brought him to New Hampshire. We brought Chris Tappan in, right? We brought Tom Pristow in from Ohio, folks that had real experience with these issues, and we've built a world-class team over there. And then we said, we're going to put in funding for 30 more caseworkers. We're going to put the funding where it needs to go, not in just more bloated management, not the same old thing, but in those caseworkers, those that are spending the time one-on-one, that at one time had thousands of backlogs of cases. I mean, think about that. We had thousands of cases that hadn't been attended to. These were potentially kids in terrible situations in their home, and we didn't have the staff to get to it. That was unacceptable. And I commend the legislature. They came together in a bipartisan way. Jeb Bradley, the Democrats, everyone came together. We simply put the best people in the room, found solutions from stakeholders. They told their stories, and we drove what became one of the most comprehensive pieces of child welfare reform the state has ever seen. And I just can't thank the legislature for making that happen. Now, there are surely more challenges. There are. Nothing is completely fixed. That's a world where we say one is too many. Nothing is ever truly fixed. So we have to stay attentive to it. Now, one area where I do want to put a lot of attention along those same lines is I truly believe we need to reform our foster care system. We have to ensure that the welfare and safety of children is preeminent. We must be their advocates and will continue to stand up for them. This is exactly who we were sent to Concord to fight for. It's the vulnerable, it's the forgotten, the kids in tough situations that are of absolutely no fault of their own. They're counting on us to have a system that can provide protections when needed, that can restore voluntary services into the home to make sure that a child or a family with a problem doesn't become a child or a family in crisis. We know that good foundations are the foundation I'm sorry, good families are the foundation of healthy communities. And therefore, we must ensure that our system is one that attracts and retains those caring families who extend their homes and hearts to foster children. And once we retain them, let's get government bureaucracy out of the way so they can simply focus on the kids. They shouldn't be worried about paperwork. They shouldn't be worried about the minutia. They've given of themselves. They've sacrificed their family. They've sacrificed their time. They want to focus on those kids and provide them with a better path. So whatever we can do, administratively, legislatively, at the local level, at the state level, simply cutting that bureaucracy, getting out of their way, and making sure these kids are on a better path, again, has to be preeminent with the state of New Hampshire. I also want to recognize the legislature in another area where we have made meaningful, sustained progress in addressing our state's mental health crisis. Again, for a while, I think it was the unspoken crisis in this state, but we've brought the issues to the forefront. We're addressing them regulatorily. We've addressed them with funding. We're making sure that we're moving that ball forward, but we know that there is a lot of work to do. And I always saw mental health when I brought the stakeholders in. That was one of those areas where, you know, when something's not working, it doesn't mean you just keep throwing money at it. That's just pushing harder in the same direction, right? You've got to sometimes have the courage and the will to go in a completely new direction. And by bringing the stakeholders in, by convincing ourselves we weren't just going to do it the same old way and hope for the best, we've really made some meaningful changes within mental health. We started engaging those on the front lines, the stakeholders, the providers. And today in New Hampshire, as a result of their direct feedback, we're rebuilding and re-engineering that entire mental health system, and today we are in greater compliance with the community mental health agreement than ever before. We've added mobile crisis teams. which help divert individuals away from emergency rooms in their communities. It allows them to get stabilized in their communities without having to run to New Hampshire Hospital. We've added 40 more community transitional beds with wraparound services that help support individuals coming out of New Hampshire Hospital. And while we've made those great strides in the past 2 years to rebuild that system, we know there's more work to do. And in the coming weeks, we will be releasing the state's new 10-year mental health plan, which is a practical roadmap to quality mental health care. This year, I'm very excited about this one. We're going to accomplish something that has been talked about for decades, but for whatever reason we quite haven't gotten around to. We will move the state psychiatric unit out of the state prison and treat those patients with the dignity and respect they deserve. Now, you cannot discuss reforms within the mental health system without acknowledging the issue of suicide in our state. We know that suicide affects far too many of our communities, and too many lives are taken from us too soon. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among young people in our state. And while there's no single answer, there's obviously more that we can do and we will do. Talking about it can be difficult. It can be very heartbreaking. Hearing the stories, asking individuals, families to come in and share their stories. But I think a lot of us know that sometimes it is simply one conversation that can save a life. A family in Bosquen, the Dickies, they know the pain of suicide more than anyone should ever have to. And just over a year ago, Paul and Martha Dickey's son Jason took his own life. I first met the Dickies at our first robotics competition, actually. And the story they told me was one where they are truly channeling their pain into hope, not just for themselves, but for all of us. And today I'm very proud to announce my support for legislation that Martha and Paul brought to me. It's called the Jason Flatt Act, named after yet another individual, Jason Flatt, who took his life about 20 years ago. Under the Jason Flatt Act, teachers in New Hampshire will complete 2 hours of youth suicide awareness and prevention training each year through the support of the Jason Foundation. The training can be provided at no cost to local districts, at no cost to the taxpayer. We finally have to understand that suicide is preventable. We all have a role to play, and it truly starts with us. Today, 20 states have passed this law, and I ask the legislature to get this done. You know, it goes without saying that, you know, students are experiencing new and more intense kinds of stresses both inside and outside the classroom. Helping students with the skills needed to successfully manage that stress and how to understand and manage their emotions, to cultivate empathy, to develop positive relationships, it's critical. It's absolutely critical in helping keep students out of a crisis or a mental health challenge. Scarlett Lewis, who works nationally to promote social and emotional learning,
yeah, I know. I'm
going to do it. You keep stepping on my big line. But you're right. Remember, always say you're right. But Scarlett Lewis, who works nationally to promote social-emotional learning, what we call SEL in schools, throughout her Choose Love Enrichment Program. It provides educators with free learning tools all the way up through the 12th grade. Scarlett is the mother of Jesse, who was killed in his classroom during the tragedy of Sandy Hook in 2012. She's another wonderful example of someone who's using the power of the individual to make a positive change. And we put an emphasis on SEL learning across this state last year. My administration has been going to schools all around our state explaining why the program is important. Several schools have stepped up to be leaders by example. One such school district which really caught my eye was Interlakes. And they've taken this program not just within the school district, but community-wide. Through the public community. It's really quite exciting. Parents, teachers, counselors, resource officers, school administrators, they've all welcomed this program, and I'm proud to say that as of today, in just a few short months, over 200 schools have now downloaded and are utilizing this program. Okay, Nate,
there she is.
And we're welcome to have Scarlett here with us today. I swear this was 20 minutes when I read it to myself last night. It's not hot in here or anything. You know, we talk about the classrooms. We talk about all the possibility and the potential that we have within the classrooms of our state. New Hampshire's exceptional public education system can simply proudly boast that some of the best teachers, some of the best administrators, and some of the best school districts in the country. It's a great source of pride that we should all have. Getting education right will truly go a long way to help maintaining our state's prosperity. It simply means more jobs for Granite Staters, less reliance on federal and state services, higher incomes, healthier citizens. There's no reason New Hampshire should not be the model for the rest of the nation when it comes to education. And over the past biennium, we've increased education grant programs in New Hampshire by over $50 million. And I fully expect the legislature will have a rigorous and thorough discussion regarding the funding for education, and I will be there with you for that discussion. I think it's something we can all agree on when it comes to the formulas, the amounts. It's something that has to be discussed, and we have to get right. But let's be careful. Let us not be so short-sighted as to think that funding is the only thing that must be addressed. We have big opportunities to expand students' access to educational choices, and we must provide additional pathways for students to simply harness their ability as an individual to learn. Last year, I advocated for and I signed legislation to expand the number of outside-the-classroom experiences and activities that can satisfy a graduation requirement. The Learn Everywhere Initiative, it's a recognition that 21st century education system is not found only within the four walls of the classroom. And consider the program. Consider an individual, a student that loves performing arts. And maybe they're taking performing arts classes and programs at the local Boys and Girls Club. Well, that local Boys and Girls Club can now apply for accreditation so that student is getting the credit in the after-school program that allows them and opens up their time to take other classes or other educational opportunities in the school day. It really is a big win for the students of this state. And in keeping with that principle, I'm proud to announce today the creation of what we are calling New Hampshire Career Academies. Working with our community college system's existing funds, our students can now take advantage of an optional fifth year of high school. That will enable them to receive a high school diploma and a certificate and a college associate's degree free of cost to the student. It comes with a guaranteed job interview with a manufacturer of choice. The revolutionary idea for the New Hampshire Career Academy is the result of the good work of Dean Graziano over at the Rochester School District. Dean put together a program with the Great Bay Community College for Rochester High School seniors. It has put interested students on a career pathway with one of Rochester's premier employers, Albany Saffron. And it has the possibility across this state now of achieving what so far has eluded so many, a model that does not cost the taxpayer or the educational system any additional money, but makes free college degree available to our New Hampshire students. And I have to give credit where credit is really due. This innovative program was something that was brought to me by Commissioner Edelblut, his hard work putting it together. He's done an absolute exceptional job. Thank you, Frank. Both initiatives that I've just discussed underscore an important principle. Government is not the solution to every problem, but government can help ensure that the doors of opportunity are open at every level. When I took office, it was my firm belief that government should be about empowering individuals, not just institutions. And just 2 years ago, I stood before you and proposed what I called the Governor's Scholarship Program. The Governor's Scholarship did exactly that. It provided opportunity for students that wasn't there before. We invested in students directly so they could choose the best path suited for them. Whether it was the community college, or the university system, or public school, or private school, or for goodness sakes, you can use it to get your nursing degree with the Red Cross. These funds are now available, and in its first year, approximately 600 students across the state took advantage, and with the program scheduled to increase about another 20% next year, frankly, I really think the opportunities are endless. Thank you for making that happen. So I'm going to take a moment again and brag about Valerie a little bit. So, because I digress all the time, when we were driving in this morning in the snowstorm, not only was I'm always proud of my wife and thinking about the amazing things, and I'm not going to embarrass her too much, but I'm listening to the radio, to Greg in the Morning Buzz, and I hear Greg, and is Greg here? Where are you? He's back there. I hear Greg and Scotty battling over who likes Valerie more. Who can blame them? But I talked a little bit about what she did with the Bridges House, right? Using bridges to build bridges. And one of the programs that, I mean, we've brought in veterans groups, we've brought in a lot of folks on early childhood education, bringing a lot of folks together, doing really amazing things, folks from outside the state sharing their experiences. Again, folks, the early childhood education one was really interesting because you had folks that are here, part of New Hampshire, a lot of nonprofits, a lot of folks from school districts, and it was amazing they hadn't met. It was really one of those things where I think we take it for granted a little bit. But to bring them together, share their ideas, and really talk about the path that not just the government should be providing, but local communities can provide, those opportunities, right? Those doorways that we can open for these kids, it was great. But another area where there was a lot of fun, she brought in a group called Project Green Schools to the Friends of the Bridges House. And it's a national program, and it awards grants to student-driven environmental and community service projects. And one afternoon, a group of students came in from various schools, various environmental projects that they had taken the initiative on, and it was like a shark tank. There was a panel of judges. We sat there. They presented their environmental projects. One little girl wanted to reduce paper in the classroom, and she was looking for some money to invest in better modems and Wi-Fi in her school. One group of kids wanted to do an outdoor classroom. They were building a pretty significant structure at high school. It was really impressive. One group was doing something with mobile apps. I mean, cutting-edge stuff. And it wasn't just, here's my idea, give us some money. It was really impressive. You saw these kids, they thought about the hows and the whys and what the true end result was, what the cost-benefit analysis of these projects were. And whether they were in fourth, fifth, sixth grade or all the way up to high school answering some pretty tough questions. It was quite inspiring, quite empowering. And that was funded really through corporate partners, right? We're able to provide those grants and some of those, I don't know if I'm, it was Walmart at the time, I don't care, I'll just say, Walmart, God bless them. They put up some great money for these kids, right? To invest in these kids, invest in these projects, and again, hopefully get people thinking and students thinking across the state for the next generation of projects. And you all know how passionate I am about energy and environmental policy. I was an environmental engineer. I spent a lot of time in the field working with chlorinated solvents and PCE and TCE. PFAS wasn't even an issue just 15 years ago. It was amazing. We didn't have the technology. Now we know, and we know the PFAS issue here in the state. DES is, I think, doing a great job working on it, finding out what we can do. We just released new standards yesterday over at DES, which I think is going to, again, provide that pathway where we're going to go with some of these issues. But environmental policy and energy policy really go together. It's just kind of the way it is. And when you have some of the highest rates of electricity in the country, the issue, I firmly believe, and I think most people agree, does have to be at the forefront, as it really affects every citizen that's stuck paying a bill. That's why we need to continue supporting an all-of-the-above strategy, which is included in our 10-year energy plan. And I've always said you need to view your energy policy through the lens of the ratepayer. And I'll be honest, I hear a lot of talk from legislators and folks running for office. They say, yes, we're going to support initiatives and we're going to lower electricity rates. And then they vote for legislation that raises electricity rates. You cannot have it both ways. That's all we ask. If you want to talk about lowering rates, then I implore you to support legislation that does just that. It's the most vulnerable among us, remember. Seniors, individuals on fixed incomes, those are at the greatest risk of high electric rates. And I think it's time, my proposal, is that we refocus our efforts on them. I'm advocating today that renewable energy initiatives should benefit low-income ratepayers first and foremost, and whether it's solar or wind or battery or biomass, whatever it is going to be, we need to ensure that the benefits of these well-intentioned, environmentally valuable programs deliver results to the people who are struggling to pay the bill each month. While other states have unfortunately decided to put developers' interests ahead of ratepayers, in New Hampshire, we simply have to put citizens first. We do not need to further raise electricity rates or raise taxes to be good environmental stewards. We just need to be smarter about how we spend the money. And when talking about climate policy, I've always said we have to take that three-pronged approach. You have to look at the environmental, the social, the economic impacts to the communities and to the individuals that bear the burden and the benefits of these programs. The Office of Strategic Initiatives and the Public Utility Commission are currently working out a plan for the multi-multi-million-dollar Clean Energy Fund, which is being made available this year. I want to see renewable energy projects for low-income families and communities to be a priority for these investment dollars. Make sure that those that bear the brunt of the cost of renewable energy are the first in line to receive the economic benefits. Well, New Hampshire has truly sent us to conquer to deliver results. And there will be times when we disagree, without a doubt. But again, let's be sure we do so in a way that's free from personal attack or unnecessary political rhetoric. We're here for a greater purpose, to represent the needs of our constituents. We can disagree respectfully. We can focus on moving forward in areas where we can find common ground. And it is not always easy. It takes constant vigilance to see some of the tougher issues all the way to the end. But we truly have to be up to the task. And I'm going to end by telling you another personal family story of ours, one that has become almost lore in our family. So let me take you back. I wasn't six, but it was back to 1985. I was in the fifth grade, and my father, who was governor at the time, we were a big family. We weren't prone to taking many family vacations. But that summer, the National Governors Conference was being held in Boise, Idaho. And we all went. We all went out to Boise. And following the conference, my father had the brilliant idea to pile us into a station wagon and drive across Idaho to see Yellowstone National Park. Tremendous opportunity. And so we piled into this Wally wagon-looking thing. And we drive, and we see the geysers, and, you know, we have a schedule to keep, so we're moving. It's a long trip. And on the way back, he says, hey, I'm looking at the map, And there's this place called Craters of the Moon National Monument. It's only 200 miles out of the way. What do you say? And as beautiful as the trip was, as grateful as we were to have the opportunity after 5 days being crammed in the station wagon, we all said, no, thank you, it's great, we're wonderful, but let's get to Boise. We're ready to go home. We've kind of had enough. So my father said, okay, and you know, he was always at the wheel and he was driving through the night. And around 6 a.m. the sun starts to come up as we're pulling into Boise. And we look around and we quickly realize we're not in Boise. It literally looks like we're on the moon. And we were stunned. We were stunned. I mean, we're crammed in the back of this thing. We're now 200 miles off course. And we said, what are you doing? What has this lunatic done to us? And he just smiled and said, you'll thank me 10 years from now. Believe it or not, there's a moral to the story. And this is very much so for a lot of the newer legislators that are here with us. We have a lot of new legislators this session. A lot of folks that have good ideas and propose good bills, and they'll get them through committee, and they'll take a victory lap. You got to see it to the end. When your mind is on something, when your heart is in it, don't fall asleep. The big decisions are often made right at the very end before something becomes law, before we initiate, right? Don't fall asleep in the car. Because you, trust me, you don't want to wake up at Craters of the Moon. Thank you so very much. It is an absolute honor to serve as your governor. And I can't tell you how humbling it is. It's an honor to work with the legislature, an honor to work with our esteemed executive council, with our commissioners, with the directors, with the citizens of the state that walk in our doors every single day. Thank you so very much. God bless this great state. God bless all of you. Thank you.